the more questions, the better. So I'll go on the blackboard, so that I go very slowly, and so people have time for questions. Well, I may need to slow it down even on the blackboard, so you ask questions even if it is only to slow it down. So I'll start by reviewing what those string theories are and how one can do computations in them. We'll then see that these computations will lead us to some problems. So this part of the talk is in the first three sections is going to be a review of things that were done around 97 through 99. And then the sections 4 through 7 will be the new stuff, which is mostly in this paper from last year in collaboration with Gibbon and the lead professor. So let me start with explaining what are rule of string theories. So rule of string theories are the decoupled theories that live on Neighbor-Schwarz fibrils in type 2 string theory. So type 2 string theory has some of them called Neighbor-Schwarz fibrils. And just like with other Gibbons, we can take some decoupled limit for the dynamics of the physics on these solitons decouples from the rest of the spacetime, and we can do the same for Neighbor-Schwarz fibrils. But there are many important differences between this case and the case of Gibbons that I'll describe in some details. NS fibrils are also related by, if you have NS fibrils with a transfer circle and you do a T-homology, then they're related to singularities and those geometric singularities. So instead of looking at the decoupled theories on NS fibrils, you can also look at the decoupled theories on geometric singularities, like ALE type singularities, quantum field singularities, and so on. And locally, the theories living on these singularities are the same as the theories living on NS fibrils, so you can view the whole string theories either in this way or in the other way, whichever interests you more. So how do we take the decoupling limit for Neighbor-Schwarz fibrils? So you have different local string theories depending on exactly which geometric singularity you look at, and also exactly which configuration of fibrils you look at. So the fibrils can be wrapped up as a manifold, and so on. I'll focus today mostly just on the simplest case. So the simplest case is just to take K flat ends fibrils in type 2 B string theory. So this is the simplest case. This case has 1-1 supersymmetry. So this is a six-dimensional theory with n equals 1-1 supersymmetry. And I'll focus on this case just to be specific, but almost everything that I say will be general and will apply also to these more general little string theories, like the ones that do different singularities in Calabria's 3-folds and 4-folds, yes.
You mentioned local, but local is the same as the decoupled series.
Right. So the decoupled.
Is there some subtlety when we go global? I mean, why did you have to say local is the same?
Well, it's just that the decoupled theory really just depends on the local dynamics. I mean, I'll describe the decoupling limit in a moment, but that really decouples the fibrils from everything that's far away from them. And
but
same
it's just a key to L.
That's right.
So there is no subtlety there.
That's right. I mean, it commutes with the decoupling limit. It commutes with the decoupling limit. That's what I wanted to say. So the duality of commutes with the decoupling limits if you take it on this side or on this side using the same theory. That's basically it, because we'll see what the decoupling limit is, and then it will be obvious that it comes with CW. So what is the decoupling limit? So the way to decouple series, as usual, is just to take, so of course we want to decouple these series from gravity and from basically from all the closed free flows. So for that, you have to take Newton's constant to zero, which feels like the square multiplying to the fourth. But we still want to remain with some non-trivial interactions. So usually what we do, say for Dirac, is we take G Newton to zero, but we keep the angles fixed in order to remain with some non-trivial interactions. For these Neighbor-Schwarz fibrils, then the lower energy theory on these NS fibrils is just a UK Young-Mills theory, supersymmetric Young-Mills theory, again with 16 supercharges. And so one way to see this is just to recall that NS fibrils in P2B are S dual to D fibrils, and that's really doesn't affect the lower energy theory. For D fibrils, of course, we have the UK super Young-Mills theory of low energies. And it's not hard to compute what's the coupling constant of this lower energy Young-Mills theory, and it turns out to be exactly given by alpha prime. Again, one way to see this is just by S duality. If we have D fibrils, then the Young-Mills coupling constant of low energies would just be the string times alpha prime. The string is always there for D fibrils, and the alpha prime is there just for dimensional reasons. Again, these are all constants, of course. And then the S duality just takes D string alpha prime, which is the inverse D string tangent to alpha prime, which is the inverse fundamental string tangent. So that's one simple way to see that the Nicholas Compton constant on these famous star rings is just given by alpha pi. Now, usually, the way that we think of the decoupling limit is we think of taking the string scale to infinity, and that's so in that way, of course, the Newton decoupling goes, so taking alpha prime to zero, and in that way, so the Newton decoupling limit involves taking alpha prime to zero, and usually for d-brings, that's enough to, well, for d-brings, we can do that and also scale the string in an appropriate way so that the Engels coupling remains finite. But for these Nevis Cross experiments, we see that this doesn't work, because if you would do this, then also the Engels coupling constant would go to zero. We'd do that with a completely free theory. So this doesn't work in this case. So for the case of the Nevis Cross experiments, we know that, well, we have to keep the Engels fixed, so we actually have to keep alpha prime fixed in the decoupling limit. But we still want to take the Newton to zero, so we see that we have to take the spring to zero in the decoupling limit. And the interesting thing about these Nevis Cross experiments is that even when we take the string to zero, which usually will be left with completely free theory, then we see for Nevis Cross experiments that's not the case. even if we just look at the slow energy theory of the suitcase of the Engels, that theory remains interacting even when we take the string to zero. And that's of course possible because this is a theory on solid opposite string theory, which is not really well described by perturbative string theory. So the decoupling limit, which basically defines the whole string theories, involves taking alpha prime fixed, or equivalently just taking the energy fixed in string scale units, while taking z string to zero, and this does of course take the Planck scale to infinity and decouple all the string loads, but it leaves the energies fixed in the string scale, and that will have some important consequences. So this is sort of the definition of Hubble string theories. Namely, we take NS5 rings, we take the string to zero, and that gives us a decoupled theory living on these NS5 rings. But of course, this definition is not very useful because it doesn't tell us how to compute anything. And if you want to compute, you need some more direct definitions. There are various direct definitions of Hubble string theories. Historically, the first one that was found was some Diels Q description, and there's also a description, the construction of these theories in terms of deconstruction. But I'll focus here on the third definition, which is the holographic definition. So these theories have a holographic dual, like other types of decoupled theories living on d-brings, and we can use that at least to do computations. I mean, not to define the theory, but at least use it to do computations. So here So let me describe what that holographic construction is. So the background, so for that we need to take this background of K Nevis Cross experiments and then apply this decoupling limit to give us the holographic dual to these little string theories and the usual logic of the CFT correspondence. The background of K Nevis Cross experiments in type 2 string theory is the following background. Very simple. So here the index mu goes from 0 to 5, that's the direction of the world volume of the NS5 ring, that the index I goes from 6 to 9, that's, these are the transverse directions. And there's this very simple form of the string frame number for NS5 rings. And there's also a non-trivial dilaton, which looks like some asymptotic z string squared plus the alpha pi r squared, and there is an Nevis Cross three form field. The following form I'm writing it here in terms of the dilaton, but you can just translate that into something in terms of R as well. So this is the background that's dual to K, Nevis Cross experiments in type 2 string theory. And then to define the little string theory, or to find the holographic dual of the little string theory, we just have to take the limit of the string going to zero in this background. Now, of course, we can't naively take the string to zero because then we can't say that with string coupling, because either the 2-5 was scaled completely to zero and we get various singularities. But what we need to do is we take this limit in such a way that keeps the dilaton finite, so we take the string to zero, but also rescale the R coordinates, again, just in the same way as one does for the usual decoupling limit of true grids, and we keep the string over R fixed, and then we end up with a finite string coupling and also with a finite vector and freeform field. And those define the holographic dual of the Hubble string theory. So what we get is the following. So the holographic dual of the Hubble string theories takes the following form. You can see that we can write the transverse coordinates as a radial coordinate and as coordinates in a free sphere. The coordinates in a free sphere just become independent of the radial coordinates, so this just becomes a free sphere of fixed radius. And then there's also, there's also a radial direction, which I'll now relabel by a coordinate phi, so that phi is some function that basically log r, I guess, in the previous coordinates. And writing it in terms of phi is useful because after we take this decoupling limit, in the dot, not only terms that's left is this term gs squared over r squared, which in the phi coordinate just becomes a linear delta. So in the decoupling limit, we just find out the linear delta directive where this constant q is 2 over square root k alpha prime. And there's also some freeform field, which I won't write down explicitly. I guess it's still given by the same expression in terms of the delta. So this is the background that we find in the decoupling limit. And the nice thing about this background is that it's very simple from the Wolff point of view. In fact, this is an exact conformal field theory. So this is just a product. So the first part here is just a sigma model of R6, and nothing else depends on these coordinates. So it's just a sigma model of R5-1. Then there's a linear delta direction. So this is R5, which is a linear delta, which again is an exact conformal field theory. And we're left with a sigma model on S3, and there's a sigma model with also k units of S and S plus. So that's exactly the WZW model for the group SE2 at level k. So the whole graphic global Mill string theory is given by this exact conformal field theory background, where all these theories are for supersymmetric series of the supersymmetric SE2 WZW model. So that's one of the main advantages of little string theories compared to other decoupling limit, the fact that the theory on the world sheet is very simple in this case, so we can often do world sheet computations, and that's, of course, as opposed to the case of U-grains, where we have Ramon-Ramon fields that we usually can't compute on the world sheet. So in order to actually do computations in the little string theories, we'll usually use this holographic dual, and we'll see where that gets us. So are there any questions? So, okay, this is all very basic. Now from this, so we can use this holographic dual to see various features of these little string theories. So I'll just describe briefly some of the features of the little string theory. And some of these features are standard features that are the same as any other holographic duality. Other features will be special to the little string theory, as we'll see later. Then one standard feature is that, just like in any other holographic duality, there's a mapping between fields living in the bulk of space-time. So the phi here is the holographic direction, and so this is analogous to the radial direction in ADS-CFT. And as usual, we have a mapping between fields in the bulk and off-shell operators in the little string theory, just like in ADS-CFT and in any other example of holographic dualities. Now, as usual, if we solve the field equations for fields in the bulk, then we find that one solution is normalizable, and the other solution is non-normalizable in the bulk, again, just like in ADS-CFT. And in order to compute correlation functions of these operators, we have to compute basically correlation functions involving these non-normalizable modes in the bulk. So in ADS-CFT, these different modes would go like a different power of the radial direction. And here, when I work in this phi variable, then these different modes go like different exponents of phi, so say the non-normalizable mode, which will look like either the q beta phi for some data, the normalizable mode will look like either the minus q beta plus 1 phi. Again, that's just by solving the, say, the field equations in the bulk. And so the so correlation functions of these non-normalizable modes are the things that translate into correlators in the little string theory. So we can use this holographic prescription to compute optional correlators in the little string theory, just like in any other holographic duality. And a second standard feature of the little string theory is that there are some special fields in the bulk which correspond to chiral operators. So there are some fields that sit in small representations of the supersymmetry group and which correspond to the chiral operators. And the chiral operators, or to say the chiral fields in the bulk, so they're, of course, translated to chiral operators in these little string theories. And it turns out that the list of chiral operators in these little string theories is precisely the same as the list that you would guess just from the lower energy limit of the little string theory, which is this six-dimensional supernatural loss theory. So it turns out that this list of operators happens to be the same as the list of chiral operators in the 6D supernatural loss theory. And this is And this itself is very analogous to the listing n equals 4 n wells. So in the six-dimensional n wells story, we have a gauge field in U, we have some fermions, and we have six scalar fields that, from the point of view of the five rings, label the position of the five rings in the four transverse coordinates. And the chiral operators are all just descendants of products of these scalar fields. So just like in n equals 4 n wells, we're also, every chiral operator is a descendant of some phrase of product of scalars, taken in a symmetric and phraseless way as an associative representation in that case. And the same is true here. The chiral operators are all just descendants of products of these scalar fields, where the indices are contrasted in some symmetric phraseless manner. And so we know the spectrum of chiral operators in the six-dimensional super n wells. We can compute the spectrum of chiral fields in the bulk just using string theory. This is an exact conformal field theory, so it's very easy to compute the spectrum. And we find that precise agreement between this, so this precisely agrees with the list of the chiral fields in the bulk. And one nice thing about the little string theories is that this agreement is actually even more precise than the usual case of ADS-CFT. Usually, this list of chiral operators gets truncated when you have more than k operators in a single phrase, where we're working with an SUK gauge group. So these operators really exist just for n to n from 2 to k, and if you have a trace of a product of more than k fields, you can re-express that as a multi-trace operator. And if you compute the spectrum of the string theory, then you find exactly the same spectrum, and it also truncates at k, and it's just related to the spectrum of chiral operators in the C2K WZW model. So in this case, you really find a completely precise agreement of the chiral operators, and not just a large net agreement like in the usual case. So let me denote these operators. So in the Lorentz field theory, you can call these operators O(n). And what I was just saying is that in the string theory, there is some operator O(n hat that has the same quantum numbers. So we have exactly the same list of these O(n hats as the list of O(s) that we find in the Lorentz field theory. So it's natural to conjecture that these operators O(n hat in the dual string theory just reduce to these supreme Hall's operators at low energies. So that's the obvious conjecture. I mean, of course, at high energies, this theory is not just a supreme Hall's theory. So these operators obviously get corrected by something. The supreme Hall itself is not phenomenological. Obviously, it's not a good theory in itself. But apparently, that doesn't change the spectrum of chiral operators. It just would probably change some of the properties at high energies. Yes?
I'm sorry. So this coordinate phi that you introduced, what is the range of it?
It's minus infinity to infinity.
So then the dilatum gets very
that's right.
Strong.
That's so right. I'll get to that in a few of the minutes. Yeah.
Right. So we need to have a little bit better definition.
That's right. So this definition is good for computing the spectrum of operators, because that I can see just by looking at large phi for UV region. But if I actually want to use this for correlation functions, it's not going to be good about it, because the spectrum diverges.
You need
have problems, and I have to introduce infrared data. Yes. Okay. So that's going to be the problem too. But even without doing that, I can already get a lot of information about the theory just by looking at what happens in the UV region, for instance, this spectrum. So, but before I go into that, let me describe some more features of the theory. So these were two standard features of the theory, which were just like in any other case of holographic duality, but still these little string theories are not really normal field theories, and they have some very special features, and some of the features of these theories are stringy. That's why they're called little string theories. And two of the stringy features of these theories, one feature is that these theories have a t-duality symmetry. So even though they're completely decoupled from gravity, they still have a t-duality, and when we compactify them on a circle of radius r, we get the same theory as when we compactify them on a circle of radius alpha prime over r. And that's easy to see just from this holographic dual. This holographic dual, obviously, if we compactify it, then we do have a t-duality symmetry in the string theory, which find the holographic dual, and so that just then you couple them and receive alpha prime finite. So the t-duality of this string theory just reduces to a t-duality of the little string theory. So this is the simplest example. So these theories are obviously non-local. I mean, they have winding modes in addition to momentum modes, and so on. So these are not just local theories, but they are still decoupled from gravity. So one of the interesting features about these theories is that these theories are non-local, but still non-gravitational, and perhaps well, together maybe within our community, because there is there are the simplest examples of both theories that are not local and not gravitational. Yes.
So the non-locality would come only if I keep R finite, but if I have, how do you, well, it's not obvious if I don't compactify the series, and it's not obvious to me that it's non-local.
Well, I don't know if there is non-local when you compactify it, I think it's pretty obvious that it's non-local also when it's decompactify. It's obvious that you can't describe it as local.
It's just, I've seen this argument before that people use this pseudo-relative statement.
Yeah.
That, you know,
and if it's a local theory, then I would say that it should be described by some local Lagrangian, and then when I put it on a circle, it would still be described by the same local Lagrangian on a circle. And that's obviously not true here. So one thing you could say precisely from here is that it doesn't come from a local Lagrangian, for instance. So that's obvious.
So you're just saying that there's only one new mode, the very instance you can get.
Right. So that makes it clear that it's not really just defined by a local action.
But there is no, wouldn't you argue that the winding mode should be coupled at least for flat?
No, well, they do, but still somehow I think that some non-local properties should still remain also at infinite flow. I mean, I can't believe that it becomes non-local just from the fact that it's somehow that doesn't make sense to me.
Or alpha prime? Alpha prime is more of a trivial feature.
Well, alpha prime is a scale, so right. So I guess I should have said that before. So alpha prime is a parameter of these theories, but that's just a scale. Which, so you can measure your energies in units of alpha prime. There's no dimensionless parameter. So I mean, of course, when you come back, if I need to get a dimensionless parameter, but in theory, in flat space, it doesn't have any dimensionless parameter. So it's just alpha prime, and that's part of the problem. And the Collins pointed out that we don't really have a good conservative expansion here because we don't have any small parameters. So we'll have to find some way to get around that. So alpha prime is a parameter that basically just sets the scale. And another stringy feature of this theory comes by looking at the high energy density of states. And we can compute that holographically in the usual way by looking at near extremal Nell Schwarz Hargreaves, which give us the holographic dual of these theories at high energy densities. And what you find is that the high energy density of states in these theories is Hagedorn-like, so the density of states grows exponentially with the energy, with a inverse Hagedorn temperature, which is 2 pi square root k alpha prime. So this is similar to the behavior of free string theory. So also in a free string theory, we have a Hagedorn-like spectrum at high energies. Of course, in an interacting string theory, we know that the interactions change the behavior of the spectrum at high energies, if we have black holes and various other things. These theories are decoupled from gravity, and in these theories, it looks like this Hagedorn temperature, this Hagedorn behavior is actually exact, and it really does persist all the way to arbitrarily high energies. So that's so this is a maybe this is a feature that's like free string theory, but it's not like interacting string theory. So that's one of the strange things about this theory. So it has some of the features of this theory is like the usual field theory, some of them are like the usual string theory. And then these theories also have a strange feature, which is neither like a field theory nor like a string theory. And that's the following feature. So we have here so if you compute the spectrum of the theory, so I was saying that when you compute the spectrum of the fields of the bulk, then we have one normalizable and one non-normalizable mode when you compute it. But in fact, that's not true for all momenta, it's only true for some momenta. And it's also part of the spectrum of this theory, also includes modes that are traveling waves along this pi direction. So if there is some mass gap towards creating a traveling wave in this theta delta direction. But if you have enough energy and you're above this mass gap, then you find that there's actually that the modes actually have a continuous parameter coming from a continuous choice of momentum along this linear delta direction. And this is very different from, say, the case of ADS and ADS CFT, that basically the boundary of ADS acts like a box, and we have a discrete spectrum inside here because we replace that by a linear delta direction, that we have a continuous spectrum. So these states are delta function normalizable. So these are delta function normalizable states in addition to these to the usual normalizable and non-normalizable states, which exist in some other regime of momentum. And these states, as I said, if you look at them, so this initial momentum is in the seventh direction, so the wave function of these states goes like e to the minus q over 2 pi, e to the minus q over 2 plus an I lambda times pi, where this lambda is basically the momentum along the pi direction. And so this lambda is a continuous parameter, so from the point of view of the six-dimensional theory, we have a continuous spectrum of fields in this theory, where if you compute the national condition for these fields, then these fields with momentum lambda give you six dimensional fields with mass squared goes like lambda squared plus a constant. So this is a strange feature. Of course, usually in field theory we have a discrete spectrum of single particle state, and then of course on top of that there's a continuous spectrum of multiparticle states. But here we have a continuous spectrum already just for the multiparticle states. So that's one of the weird things about these theories. But still, this continuous spectrum only starts at a mass squared that's 1 over k alpha prime. So if you compute the natural condition for the field and you see what's the minimal value of this constant c, then you find that this continuous spectrum starts at a mass 1 over k alpha prime. So above that, there is a continuous spectrum of multiparticle states, but below that, there is still a discrete spectrum, and in particular, of course, the tolerance is you're expecting it here, just at the UK superimposed theory. And f squared equals 0. So there is some mass gap, and below this mass gap, it would appear that the theory behaves in a normal way, and you really just have the UK superimposed theory, but above this mass gap, there is this continuum. So that concludes part one. Are there any questions about this? Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Is this superimposed counting which gives the hexagon density of six?
Well, the superimposed is obviously not a good description of high energy, so it's not so obvious how you would count. Obviously, if you just count the states of the free angles theory, then that doesn't give you high ground, that behaves like a six-dimensional field theory. And we don't really know how the field, at high energies, we can't trust that description because the 68 angles theory is strongly coupled at high energies. So it's not obvious how to reproduce it from any counting like that.
So this is a counting only from the string worksheet.
It's from this holographic dual, basically, right? You can see it also in these other instructions. And if you define the whole string theory by BLCQ, you can also compute it and see that we have the same behavior. But certainly we don't know how to understand it in terms of some free string degrees of freedom at high energy. So that's one very interesting question about these theories, is just to really try to understand where this hexagon density comes from. Does this theory become some free string theory at high energy, along with using asymptotic free string theory or something like that? But none of that has been realized so far. It's still very mysterious. I don't have anything more to say about that today. Any more questions? Okay, so So as was pointed out, this holographic duality is problematic because the background, which is dual to these both string theories, is a linear delta background. And if we go to the region of small pi, then the string coupling diverges. So we can't really use this background to do computations. So first, it looks like we gave a definition of the theory, but it's completely useless because we can't use it to do any computations. So we have to find some way to deform these theories and get rid of this strong coupling region in this pi direction. And the way to do that was found by Gibbon and Kutesov in 1999, and they called it double scale global string theory, or DSLSD for short. So I'll describe that briefly here. So if you look at the theory of these NS hybrids, then this theory has a moduli space. Obviously, each of these NS hybrids breaks out of the supersymmetry, so there's no force between them, and you can just move them around arbitrarily without any cost in energy. So we can just move these brains around and put them at any positions that you want, and this moduli space is just part of the 4k mod escape corresponding to the positions of the fibrains in their four transverse dimensions. And this is actually also the same as the moduli space of this low energy six-dimensional superimposed theory. As usual, the only interactions between the scalars here are commutator square type interactions, so we can diagonalize all these scalars on the moduli space, and we find exactly the same moduli space. What I described up to now is the background that we get when all the time vectors are sitting at the same point. But we could also just look at any other point in this moduli space and try to see what the dual background is. Of course, in many cases, that gives complicated descriptions. I can say in n equals 4 equals, we get very complicated dualities when we look at arbitrary points on the Coulomb branch. But it turns out that there is here a very nice point on the moduli space where the dual description is actually very simple. So to describe that point, let me write the scalars in terms of complex linear combinations. So instead of working with the four real scalars, I'll define two complex combinations of these scalars. And then I want to look at the specific point in the modelized space where one of these complex scalars is just zero, while the other one is given by a clock matrix, so with all the different phases of phi over 2 pi I over k. And what this means is that we have all the fibers sitting at the origin in this 6, 8, 8, 6, 9 plane, but we spread them around in a circle in this x, 6, 6, 7 plane. So in the x, 7, x, 6 plane, the fibers are just sitting uniformly spread on a circle. So that's, of course, in terms of the modelized space, this point is as good as any other point. And at this point in modelized space, the SUKK symmetry of R and D is broken down to U1, to the k minus 1 symmetry. And these theories, I guess I didn't mention it, but it's obvious. So the gauge SUK symmetry is broken to U1 to the k. These theories also have a global SO4 symmetry, which is just the rotation symmetry of the transverse direction. The angle theory just rotates these four scalars. And that symmetry is broken at this point in the modelized space to U1 cross ZK, where the U1 is the rotations of this x8, x9 plane, and the ZK is the rotations in this x6, x7 plane, which remain unbroken. So this is some specific point in the modelized space. And a priori, I didn't gain anything from going to this point. But one thing which is clear is that when I go to such a point in the modelized space, I do have a dimensional parameter down to my theory, because I've broken here the gauge symmetry. The W bosons, which correspond to the octagonal matrix elements, all get a mass, which is proportional to this parameter, are zero. So I now have the dimensional parameter, which is Nw divided by the strict scale, which is the obvious parameter that we had before. So this is a dimensionless parameter. And at least in principle, once we have a dimensionless parameter, then there's a potential for having a good correlation theory. And we'll see that that will actually happen here. So that's the definition of the point in modelized space that we want to be working on. And it's not too hard to find the holographic dual of this point in the modelized space. One way to do it is just to look at which scalars obtain events in this diagram. At this point in modelized space, and then just turn them on in this background and see what you get. So for instance, at this specific point in modelized space, if you look at the trace of b to the k, then that's non-zero. Look at the traces of the other b to the l's for l less than k, and the traces of all the a to the l's have zero expectation value, and that already sort of uniquely determines what the background is. So I won't give all the details of that. The dual background turns out to still be given by an exact conformal field theory. The conformal field theory is now a product of two classic models. It's the product of SL2 mod U1 times SU2 mod U1, both of double k, and modded out by global ZK. So I won't derive that. I won't derive that in detail, but say if you're conjecturing, it's easy to check this conjecture just by computing these expectation values for these operators. So each of these operators, we know how it maps to the string theory operator. We can compute some kind of function in this background and see that you get the right answer. Now, what does this background look like geometrically? And the SC2 mod U1 is of some compact conformal field theory. The interesting part is this SL2 mod U1, which looks, so there's an Euclidean SL2 mod U1, which looks like a cigar shape, which hopefully everybody has encountered it at some point. Asymptotically, this just looks like a linear delta times a circle. So the linear delta is, so of course, asymptotically, this background should look just like the holographic dual that we had before, because we're just turning on events here, which are not supposed to change the asymptotic behavior. And indeed, asymptotically, this gives a linear delta times S1, and this S1 times the SU2 mod U1 just gives us that the original S3 or the SU2W model that we had before. But the nice thing is that now we have this minimal value of phi, so in this background, so the cigar has some tip, and the delta, so asymptotically the string coupling goes to zero, and then it grows and reaches the maximal value at the tip of the cigar here. So the string coupling is always less than or equal than this string at the tip of the cigar. And this string turns out to be given by a string over W. So of course, it has to be some function of this dimensionless parameter. And it happens to be this function, M string over W. And that means that if we take MW much bigger than a string, then we have decoupling everywhere, and we can trust string perturbation theory. It's easy to see why the string coupling at the tip of the cigar has to take this value. One way to see that is to note that when you have this picture of the Mitter-Schwarz hybrids on a circle, that the W bosons come from having UI brains that are stretched between these NSI brains. That's just this little visual picture of strings stretched between V chi brains. So the W bosons are given by this configuration, and then if you follow that configuration through the C-couples limit, then you find that these W bosons are just D0 brains sitting here. And the mass of the D0 brains sitting here is, of course, just one over the string, or n string, divided by this string. So the D0 brains become heavier and heavier as you go away because the string coupling becomes weaker there. So they feel a potential and drives it towards the tip. And then, of course, they can't go any further. And their mass, when they sit at this point, is m string over ds tip, which we identify with mw because these are the w bosons. So that's one way to derive this formula. So that's the holographic globe of this point in the modulized space. And as I said, the nice thing about it is that it's weakly coupled everywhere. So there's also an alternative description. This SL2 module 1 is believed to be identical also to the n equals to the build theory. So people who prefer n equals to the build can work with that. That's of course equivalent. And this is the description that we'll use for computing the correlation functions. And if we now try to compute correlation functions, then perturbation theory is well behaved, at least up to energies that are of order 1 over g string. So of course we expect that if energies of order mw, perturbation theory will break down, because we have these difference and so on. It's just like the usual breakdown in string theory. But this mw is now much above the string scale, so at least for energies of this order, perturbation theory should be valid, and we should be able to compute all the correlation functions in this range of energies reliably. And in particular, of course, we can now compute reliably correlation functions with lower energies, and this compares to what we expect from the superimposed theory. So now there at very low energies, we expect to just get a U1 with a K plus 1 gauge theory, and so we should reproduce those results at low energies, and at higher energies. Well, and in principle, we should be able to do computations all in this whole range of energies. So in the rest of the stuff, what I'll do is I'll describe various computations that we do using this holographic dual and compare them to what we expect at this point in modelized space and see if they behave as we expect or not.
So can you comment on the relation of this to the black hole? So you take in black hole geometry, but just flat and slide frame, we can also get the sigma across the SL2 module 1 level K across the 3-2.
You mean if you look at the near extremal?
Right.
So that's a completely different way to get this.
So, but what's the difference between two? I mean, what I'm trying to say is that naively the Wolfshift series was the same, right?
The case that you described is what we get from a near extremal fiber, and that's R5. Where we have this, now we're looking at Euclidean theory, we're looking at the theory of finite temperature,
right.
And these are our plot across SL2 module 1 plus SU2.
Right.
So this is very different from this. The difference is both in orbital, the P has plus 0 here. And this, in principle, if you do it at finite energy densities, then you get the Lorentzian SL2 module 1 and so on. So that's a very different case. So that case is very interesting in itself. That just leads to the cyclone behavior that I mentioned, but it's a very different case.
And so here there are no topologies that come up in that case if you start looking at the loop corrections.
Well, in either case, should there be any topologies? I mean, in both of these cases, the string coupling is bounded. We expect string perturbation theory to be well behaved.
But there was Kutasov argument that if in that case we will do the loop correction to have it on some dynamic, then we will get a negative.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's why I'm asking naively.
But that problem doesn't arise there. There are two questions of thermodynamics, and indeed you have a range of problems because if you try to pick the temperature above the Hegelian temperature, then not surprisingly, you get divergences because the partition function doesn't exist anymore. But these questions are really very specific to this case, and you don't.
So in that case, the loop corrections is well defined, and we can.
That's right.
This case is
all for the 16 super series.
I mean, because you know the Sikar streets to zero size, so I cannot put.
I guess yeah, I could put a little bit longer.
Right. Okay. So anyway, I mean, I. Anyway, what I'm going to do next is, I mean, I explained that I can really compute fewer things reliably, so let's try to do something and really see if we get reasonable answers or not. So what's the simplest thing we can compute? I mean, so I guess the simplest thing is a two-point function. So we can look, for instance, at operators BL that are traced with B to the L in the lower energy field theory. That's a simple operator just made out of these scalar fields. And we can consider some two-point function of this operator BL at momentum T, BL star at momentum minus T. That's a simple Frelatian function that you can compute. So we can compute this in the lower energy super Yagmos theory. It's a very simple computation. So, and we can compute, well, we might compute this at leading order in 1 over W. So the expansion in 1 over W becomes really the string perturbation theory. So when we do these comparisons, we really are interested just in the answers of leading order in W. And the leading order in W, so when you compute this correlation function, each of these b's inside this trace, you can either replace it by a bed or insert it into an actual b field that will be contracted between these two operators. And the leading power of W comes if you just replace all but one of the fields here by their bed and all but one of the fields here by their bed. That obviously gives you the most power of W because the bed is proportional to W. So if you do it this way, you get an answer that looks like mw to the 12 minus 1 divided by p squared, or the one where p squared is just the pole because this is a massless scalar field. So that's a completely trivial computation to do in the lower energy field theory. And so we can ask, so what you would hope is that when you do the computation in string theory, as I said, in string theory, we know what are the vertex operators that correspond to each of these lower energy field theory operators, we can do exactly the same computation in the field theory, and that's if we get that answer or not. And it so happens that we do indeed get exactly the answer that we expect, also the string theory computation. So if we constants, we get precisely the same answers that we expect here, also from the string theory. So that's a nice test that what we're doing makes sense, at least as far as this computation goes. However, we can then look at some other two-point functions. So for instance, we can look at the operators AL, which are traced with A to the L, and we can compute their correlation functions in the lower energy field theory. Now, in the lower energy field theory here, the A's don't have a bed, so the leading contribution to this comes from contracting all the different L fields between these two different operators. And that actually goes like no powers of MW and some very relatively high power of P. It certainly doesn't have a pole, because there's no pole once you do that. All the momentum integrals over there. So that's what we expect from the field theory point of view. Then we can compare that to what we find in the string theory. And in the string theory, if you compute the same correlation function, it was found that, surprisingly, it actually doesn't show this behavior, but it shows exactly the same behavior as for the V-type operators, namely, it does have a pole at zero momentum. And that's very surprising because, as I mentioned, we expect that the rule of string theories that flow energies should just reduce to this U1 to the K field theory, and we expect that to be true in all the correlation functions. But here it was found that, at least for this specific correlation function, we get a completely different answer from the string theory, even at very low energies, and we can make B squared to zero here. So we're really working at very low energies. And still the answer seems to dramatically disagree between the little string theory and the low energy field theory. So this was a paradox that was around for almost 5 years, between 1999 and 2004. And various different explanations were suggested for how to explain this paradox. One possible explanation, of course, is that we're making mistakes on other computations, that the computations have been checked by many people. Another possibility is that maybe this holographic description is more subtle than we think, and so holography breaks down here. And obviously, holography and the no-nil contact is different from ADS. There are all these strange things, like this continuous spectrum that they defend. So maybe holography breaks down somewhere. Or maybe somehow there are additional fields of flow energies, so we assume that these are the only fields of flow energies, these are the only ones we know about, but maybe there could be some additional fields. And this sort of suggests that there should be more fields of flow energies because we have to recall with this two-point function, even though from the point of view of the super Yagmos theory, we wouldn't expect the pole, so maybe there is some new particle that comes in and gives rise to the pole. So these were all things that people suggested. And what I'll try to convince you of is that the actual explanation of this is more complicated. And the actual explanation is that there is some strange form of UVIR mixing in these field theories. So you can think of that as a breakdown of the Wilsonian RG approach. So usually one would expect that when you compute correlation functions of lower RGs in a field theory, then of course it's enough to just include the lower RG degrees of freedom, and these would give you all the poles that you have. I mean, that's the usual approach that's valid in a local strong theory. In a local strong theory, you can always do this Wilsonian approach, compute lower RG correlation functions just by using the lower RG degrees of freedom. But in this little strong theory, it will turn out that that's wrong, and there is some strange form of UVIR mixing, which means that you can't ignore the UV degrees of freedom even when you're computing very low energy correlation functions. So in the rest of the talk, I'll show where that happens and then see what we can do with that. So are there any questions before I
go? How do you cancel the, you know, usually two point functions considered zero, the
critical component. Right, but that always cancels, and you see, that even between SL2, so that comes from SL2, but there is an infinity that cancels the infinity from the deformers group of the rotator. It's the same infinity. You can, I mean, SL2 is just ADS3, and you can ask how that happens for ADS3, how you get two point functions to be non zero in strict theory, because you know that the CFT has non zero two point functions, and there is some infinity coming from the radial direction that cancels the zero that you would usually get for two point functions, with exactly the same infinity or zero. So that's more or less well understood. And if those are the final answer, which is precisely this answer. Are there any other questions?
For R0
equals 0, there's no mixing. Well, R0 equals 0, we don't know how to compute. So, and we only know how to compute in this regime where R0 is very large because it's string scale. So, but obviously, if there's a mixing in some like in the moduli space, there's only the regular. And for this, and this will be another, this is just another indication of the non-locality of the theory. So this would answer all this question. So this would be an indication of non-locality that's there already in kind of all of it. So you certainly expect it to be there independently of where you are, but if you can only compute it at this specific point in the modeling space. So what I'm going to do next is try to understand better where these poles come from. So in order to see, so the question is, so the first pole we expect that it really comes from this low energy massless field, which is exchanged here between these two operators. And the second pole, of course, is very mysterious. So let's just try to follow in the string theory where these poles come from and hope that will help us to understand this apparent paradox. So again, in the field theory, the origin of the pole in the first computation is clear. Again, we just know these operators VL and VSTARL, and each one of them we just replace all of one of the operators by their random, and then just exchange this massless particle, probably, it goes like 1 over p squared. Now, so this pole is there in the supine function, but in fact, what this diagram tells us is that this pole should be there in any correlation function where I have BL of p times any other operators, so y up to O m or something. So in any correlation function like this, I can always take this BL operator and replace L minus 1 of the b's by the fragment, and the other one by field, and this would always go like 1 over p squared. So we expect that generic correlation functions involving this operator should all go like 1 over p squared and plus regular things. But generically, in any correlation function like this, we expect to have a fold. And so the question is, can we see that's really true also from the string theory point of view? So where do these poles come from in the string theory? So first of all, it's obvious that they don't come from the R5-1 part. If you compute correlation functions, the R5-1 contribution is the same as the usual, similar to the usual 10-dimensional, and Tian amplitudes, and so on. We know that these amplitudes have poles as functions of combinations of momenta, which correspond to some intermediate states, but they never have poles as a function of a single momentum. So obviously, that can't be the origin of the pole, and also the SC2-1 can't be the pole, because that's just a compact CFT. So the pole obviously has to come from this SL2 factor. So in order to see that, we have to analyze in a bit more detail the SL2 Modi-1 part of the contribution. The SL2 Modi-1 contribution to the correlation function. So when we compute a correlation function, it's basically going to be a product of, well, at least before we integrate over the world series, it's just a product of contribution from these three conformal field theories. And the fold is just going to come from here. So we have to understand this part. So how do we compute an SL2 Modi-1? So SL2 Modi 1 is related to SL2, of course, by this homology, which is to define SL2 Modi 1 CFT. And that means that one way to compute correlative functions in SL2-1 is just compute correlative functions in SL2 and then divide out by the U1 part. Of course, we all know how to compute correlative functions in the U1 conformality of the root. It's just a free compact scalar. So if we have poles here, then the invariant comes from this SL2 part, basically. So how does this relation work? So let's first start by reminding ourselves what are the vertex operators in the SL2 conformal field theory. SL2, WZW model, is just a sigma model on ADS3. And the vertex operators, a good basis for the vertex operators in this theory are the vertex operators that correspond precisely to the fields of the dual CFT. So whenever we have a sigma model in SL2, we know that that's dual to some two-dimensional conformal field theory, and that dual field theory has some operators OJ of X. And corresponding to each of these operators of the dual CFT, then there is a vertex operator, phi j of x, now it depends also on the world g-coordinate z. So for every vertex operator of j of x in the dual CFT, then we know that there should be some vertex operator phi j of x and z in this SL2 conformal field theory whose correlation functions, when we integrate them over the world, so it will give us the correlation functions of these OJs in the field theory. And indeed, there is such a basis for the vertex operators of SL2, of the SL2 WZW model, which was investigated in great detail by Teschner and various other people. And this vertex operator has the property that it transforms under Wolfschmidt CFTs. This is a primary operator with dimension minus jj plus 1 over k, and under the space-time conformal transformation in the context of this idea CFT duality, it transforms as a space-time and a primary operator with dimension j plus 1. And the values of j that appear in the CFT go between minus 1/2 and k minus 1 over 2. So that's just a well-known property of this SL2 WZW model. So the problem with these vertex operators is that they don't have good quantum numbers under the C1, so we can't directly translate the correlation function of these operators to the ones of SL2-1. So we have to choose different linear combinations of these vertex operators that will have good quantum numbers under the C1 that we want to divide by, and then we'll be able to just write each of them as a combination of vertex operators in SL2-1 times C1 and use that to compute the correlation functions. And it turns out that the way to do that is to define vertex operators phi j, feminine and bar from C, which are the following sort of complexified Fourier transforms of these operators phi j of x and z. So if we define these transform variables phi j, feminine and bar, then one can convince oneself, again, I won't go into the details because they're not so interesting, but it's easy to see if you follow the analysis that this specific linear combination of these phi j's does have good quantum numbers under this U1 part of the CFT. It has a momentum that goes like n minus n bar, and it has a winding number in this U1 that goes like n plus n bar. So these specific operators, we do know how to write them as some operator in the coset, which I'll call vj m n bar, is an operator in SL2-1, times some operator in the U1 conformal field theory, which is, again, just some exponent of a free compact scalar field. And what that means is that so the computations that we're interested in for these double scaled little string theories.
In front of you, sorry.
Right side. Okay, so if we want to compute correlation functions for these double-scale dual string theories, then we need to compute a correlation function of these v operators in the SL2-1. But the easy way to do that is to compute the correlation function in SL2 and then divide by the U1 part. So what I'm saying is that what we're interested in for the DLCQ processes is, for purposes of computing DLCQ correlation functions, is some correlation function involving some product of these v's. This two-point function and any other computation that we do will reduce into something like this in the SL2 part times something else coming from the R5 line and the SL2 line part. So this is going to be given by the correlation function in the SL2 part, so which I can write as integral b2 x1 of r, integral b2 x2 of and so on. So I can replace each of these by my decision well over the corresponding correlation function in the SL2 conformal field theory. And then this SL2 part still has also the V1 contribution, so then I have to divide that by some correlation function in V1, but that's physics for fields, so there's going to be some function that depends on the J's and the N's and on the Z's, but this is a function that's trivial to compute and which I can always divide by. This function obviously doesn't have any singularities, it's just a function, a correlation function in this U1 CFT. So if you have any faults in these correlation functions, then they never come from this part. So I'm sorry, this is a bit technical, but from now on, I mean, basically, if you just accept this formula, then everything will follow in a simple way from this formula. So if there are any questions.
Yes. What's the mapping to the VL and the AL?
Well, okay, so each of these VLs, so as I said, it has some string theory operator in VL hat, and this VL hat is always, so of course, it's going to be some e to the IP dot x of the alpha 1 part, and then it's going to involve some specific VJ MM bar in the SL2 mod U1, and also some other operator in the SU2 mod U1. And you can compute, so these MM bars are going to be related to L and in a specific way, and the J is shown by dot shell.
Is it a simple, is there an integration between winding the momentum modes?
Right, so these Vs happen to be the ones that carry momentum, that carry winding along the SL2 mod U1, and the A's happen to carry momentum along the SL2 mod U1. That already tells you basically how to map these parameters to the bar. But again, that's, I mean, that it's very straightforward to do this translation since we know that's the full spin theory. Okay, so how can we get poles in an expression like this? And in particular, we expect to get poles. So, as we said, for the specific operators that correspond to these VLs of P's, we expect to get poles going like 1 over P squared. So, how can that happen? So, how can we get any pole from an integral like this? So let's look at the behavior of this integral near x1 equals 0. So near x1 equals 0, this SL2 correlator is regular. This SL2 correlator is here at x1. There's nothing special about this point x1. This just corresponds to some correlator that would be used in ADS3 CFT correspondence. And this x1 is just, there's nothing special about that point there. But this integral does become singular. This is an integral of exactly the same part, the same type that appears in the Venetian amplitude, for instance, and so on. So those of you who remember how the Venetian amplitude behaves will recall that this integral, the contribution from the region of x1 going to 0 to this integral gives a fold that goes like 1 over j1 plus m1 plus 1, at least if m1 equals m1 bar. Otherwise, it's slightly more complicated, but you still have folds. So again, so near this region, this integral goes like v2 x1 over x1 to the 2 plus, over x1 squared times. Well, okay, so if j1 plus m1 is minus 1, then this goes like v2 x1 over x1 squared, which gives you the fold. And if you do this carefully, then you see that the fold exactly behaves like this. So we have a fold at j1 equals minus m1 minus 1. And as usual, for the finite integral beyond the fold, you do an analytic continuation again, just like you do in string perturbation theory. And you find that there's a full series of folds. So there's a fold here, and then there's another fold at minus m1 minus 2, minus 1 minus 3. And so on until you get to the minimal value that's allowed by J1, which is minus 1/2. So these amplitudes do have poles as a function of the J's. The x1 integral gives a pole as a function of J1, the x2 integral gives a pole as a function of J2, and so on. Now, this gives us a pole as a function of the J's. Now, that's not quite what we want. We want to have a pole as a function of the P's. But the two are actually related by the Maxwell condition. So, again, we're talking about vertex operators of this type. And we have a Maxwell condition for vertex operators of this type that tells us that 1/2 p squared minus, so that's the dimension of e to the p dot x, and we're getting units of alpha prime equals 2 now, just for simplicity. So we have the 1/2 p squared is the dimension of this is minus j equals 1 over k, and then we have some number coming from the SU2 module 1 part. So that has to be equal to 1 for this to be a good vertex operator in string theory. And that tells us that this index j is related to the momentum by the following formula. And then if we use that and translate this pole as a function of j to a pole as a function of momentum, that means that these poles become poles as a function of the momentum. So when we look at a correlation function like this, then j is not an independent variable. It's really just given by this formula in terms of p squared, and these poles become a series of poles, this function of p squared happening at various values, minus 1 squared, minus 2 squared, and so on. And this is q1 at the moment of this. So when we put this into a full correlation function of operators like this, then these poles as function of j's would become poles as function of lambda, and that's precisely what we expect. And again, these poles for us completely independently of what all these other operators are. To see this pole, I didn't have to say anything about what all these other operators at the correlation function were. So this is very different from the usual poles in string theory. Again, these poles just depend on a single operator, and they happen whenever that single operator has a specific momentum. And again, that's precisely what we expect from the field theory point of view. As I said, also in the field theory, we expect these operators to have a pole as a function of momentum in any correlation function. And we see that we reproduce that here from the string theory. So everything seems to be working very nicely so far. Are there any questions about that?
Do you always get smart?
No. So as I mentioned already, this actually has a series of poles as a function of j, and that would give us a series of poles as a function of p squared. So even if the first pole is massless, and for these b operators, this first pole will happen to be massless, but then there's a series of poles on top of that. So there's
no massless pole. Do you always get massless poles?
Oh, no, no. Well, OK. It depends on which operator you're looking at. But no, you don't always get a massless pole. In many cases, you don't. OK. Now, what does this tell us? So one thing it tells us is that we can do an OFZ type formulation of these theories and compute an S matrix. So if you compute so if you now consider some correlation function of O hat momentum P1 up to O n hat momentum Pn. So just like in field theory, we can now consider the case where each of these momenta approaches its pole. And when the momentum approaches the pole, then we expect that this pole corresponds just to creating some on-shell particle. And then if we take out that pole, just like in the LC formula, then that will give us the S matrix. So as we go, as the pi squared goes to minus mi squared, and assuming that these operators really have a pole minus mi squared, then this should behave like 1 over p1 squared plus m1 squared, then pn squared plus m1 squared, have something finite, and we interpret that finite remainder as the S matrix for this little string theory. So one nice thing that this allows us to do is to compute the S matrix for scattering low energy particles in these little string theories. And so it's nice to be able to do that. Of course, usually holographic dualities, we have more control theories and theories like that, but don't really have an S matrix here in this little string theory, which at low energies is just a U1 gauge theory. But we do have an S matrix, we can compute it by using this formalism. And of course, this S matrix, we expect that it will have various poles. So for instance, when we scatter the particles, we expect to have poles which come from intermediate states. But those poles will be similar to the usual poles in string theory, namely they will only show up after the integration over the world sheet positions. So here, the poles that I was describing up to now occur independently at every world sheet position. These are scoped from these S integrals. And obviously, they will survive when I do the world sheet integrals. But there will also, of course, be additional poles coming from the world sheet integrals, just as the usual case of string theory. And they'll be real poles in this S matrix, which correspond to the intermediate states in the scattering, and so on. So everything seems to work very nicely. And so we can now see that. So for each operator, okay, so now if we go back a bit, so what we want to see is for each of these operators, which poles does it create? So we can just follow these formulas, and for a given operator in the little string theory, we see what is its ultimate U1 part, and then by following this procedure, we can see what are the poles that we found. So for the operators V hat L of P, that's what we said should have to be various V to the first, then we find that there is indeed a massless pole, just like we expect, and then the next pole, so this is poles at S squared equals 0, and then the next pole happens to be at 2 over k times L minus 1 for over k L minus 2, and so on. So there's a full series of poles for these operators. If we look at these operators A hat L, on the other hand, then what we find is that these operators actually have no poles of this type, which is, again, just like we expect. So these operators, as I said, they don't create any one particle state because the A's don't have a depth, so they create an L particle state. We shouldn't have a pole generically in the correlation function, and indeed, we find that the poles of this type that would give us poles of generic correlated functions don't exist for this for these operators. So from this point of view, it looks like everything fits in very well with what we expect in the normal field theory. But of course, there's still a mystery of where this flow implementation comes from. So I'll come back to that in a moment. But at least we see that there's this specific origin of poles that corresponds to creating intermediate massless states. And as far as that origin is concerned, then we find exactly the poles that we expect. Now, there's another way to think about these poles, which may be more familiar to those of you who were around back in 91. One can think about these poles. So these are poles that we get when we do computations in this SL2 mod. You want the formal field theory. And one can think of, and so these are poles corresponding to having some intermediate normalizable states here. And one can think of these normalizable states as some bound states that live here near the tip of the cigar in this SL2 mod U1. And these were discussed already many years ago by Dan Perlinde. They argue that if you have a winding mode around the cigar, then that should have, so that's of course attractive here to the tip because it has lower energy here. And they argue that the winding mode should have some spectrum of discrete bound states here at the tip. And indeed, that spectrum of the tape pong is exactly the same as the spectrum that I'm talking about here. But with the momentum modes, and the momentum modes are repelled away from this tip, and they shouldn't have any bound states. And indeed, these operators are winding modes, and these are momentum modes. So we've used this very complicated analysis just to come back to something that's sort of completely obvious, just by looking at this diagram and seeing where we expect to have normalizable states and where we don't. But here we did it really using the exact CFT, so these results are really rigorous and trustworthy. So that concludes part four. So are there any questions about these LSZ type poles that come from intermediate states before I go on to discuss other types of poles that will be relevant for this? Okay, so let me now move on. So we still have the mystery of where this pole came from. And it turns out that the origin of this pole is completely different. And it still comes from the SL2-1-1 part, of course, as I argued that it has to, but it doesn't come from these singularities that happen at x going to 0, or there are also similar singularities at x going to infinity, but it has a completely different origin. And this origin is basically from an infrared divergences in these theories. So as I mentioned, these vertex operators, so say these Vj and bars, they behave if you semi-classically just expand them in the signal model, then you find that for large phi, they behave like, either the Qj phi times something. And then when you compute the correlation function in the SL2-1, then you always have a zero mode over the integral of this phi coordinate. And so if you compute some product of operators, then well over the zero mode would include some product of operators of this type, either the Qj1 phi, the Qj3 phi, and so on. And there's also a background term for this field because it's a linear delta under it. So there's also a term that goes like either Q1 minus G. So of course, the vertex operators go like this plus corrections that go like either the minus Q phi to some powers. But this gives us the leading behavior of these operators at large phi. And just from computing this integral at large phi, we see that this has a pole that goes like 1 over J1 plus J2 and so on up to Jn plus 1 minus G. So just from the zero mode integral of phi, we see that we can also have another pole as a function of the J's, which has this completely different origin. So this pole actually comes from the region of large phi, of phi going to infinity, as opposed to these other poles that came from this region of small phi where we have the bound space limit. But still, this also gives us a pole as a function of the J's. And we can also get poles like this with various shifts by inserting various interaction operators and so on, just like people more familiar with the Liouville theory will recognize all these games, which are often done in the Liouville theories. So these poles have a very different origin. They come from different regions in the phi space, and also if you do these x integrals, then they don't come from the region near x equals 0 or infinity, but they come from regions where several of the x's approach each other. So also there we have a completely different origin. And indeed, these poles look completely different from the other poles, as I said. So here, if I replace the J's by the omega, then this would look like a pole that goes like 1 over Q1 squared plus Q2 squared and so on, plus Pn squared. plus something. So this looks very different from these one particle poles that I was at before. But there's exactly one case where a pole like this can look similar to the poles that we had before, and that's the special case of two-point functions. So if you look at a two-point function of some operator of momentum p and some operator of momentum minus p, then you can have a pole that goes like 1 over p squared coming from exchanging a massless state between them. But you could, so of course, as we said, each of these operators you would expect to contribute to 1 over p squared, but in the two-point function you would also get another p squared coming from the propagator, which would give you this 1 over p squared behavior of the two-point function. But if you look at a pole like this for the case of the two-point functions, then because in the two-point functions p2 squared has to be exactly the same as p1 squared by momentum conservation, then in the special case of two-point functions, poles like this would also look like 1 over p squared plus some number, just because of their form. So poles like this, even though generally they're completely different from the one-particle exchange type poles, in the special case of two-point functions, they could actually look exactly the same. Because in the two-point function, you only have one independent momentum, then it would also just look like poles as a function of this single momentum. And indeed, if you follow this computation that I mentioned before of the pole in this correlator of these A alpha operators, then you find that indeed the origin of the pole in this computation exactly comes from this large phi region rather than from the small phi region. So in this special case, this has a 1 over p squared, which comes from the large phi region. So what does this mean? So this large phi region, there are no like bound states living there, so that means that this pole doesn't really come from exchanging like particles. Rather, it comes from integrating over this phi momentum, over this phi direction of the linear delta. So one way to understand it is that in this phi direction, as I mentioned, we have this continuum of modes, and somehow all of these modes, even though they're all very massive, and in fact they're about some mass gap, then somehow together, at least in this computation, they conspire to give the massless pole. So that looks sort of miraculous from a Lorentz field theory point of view, but that's what the string theory computation tells you. It tells you that even though in this region you don't have any light fields living, then somehow all the heavy fields together give you a pole exactly at p squared equals zero. So that realizes what I was saying before. It looks like that usual renormalization group approach breaks down in these theories. If you would try to compute the correlation functions that Lorentz uses just by using the massless fields, you would get the wrong answers, and somehow you can get massless poles coming from a sum over many different massive fields. So that's the way that we proposed to resolve this paradox. So basically, again, the paradox was that we had this pole at the wrong place. What we're saying is that, well, we had a pole at a place where there wasn't any massless state. And what we're saying is that this pole really is not associated to any light state, but it's associated to this continuum of massive states, while the other pole was really associated to a massive state. And again, using this whole formalism of following this interpretation and seeing precisely where the pole comes from, we can distinguish these two cases. Well, in fact, the only case where they could look similar to each other is a two-point function, so it's not too hard to distinguish them. And you can follow all these poles and see in which cases these poles really come from the Lorentz field theory, and in what cases they come from this weird UBIR exchange where a combination of massive fields conspires to give us a massless pole. So, questions? Yes.
So, is there some idea of what you have to do to the series that you need to remove the pole?
Well, it's not clear. I mean, so obviously, anything that if you put in some UV cutoff or something, then this pole disappears.
But
it's true that anything that you do in the UV would make it disappear. So we don't know how to do anything in the UV.
My question is, so as long as it is a linear dilaton background,
that's right.
Says that that's a generic feature of asymptotically linear dilaton background.
That's right. Okay. So poles of this type and this type of UVR, I think, seems to be completely generic in linear dilaton background.
And so as long as, I guess then I would have to deform, this linear dilaton background.
That's right. That's really changing the high-end properties drastically. Yeah, we don't really want to do that. Then it's not a little string theory anymore, then it's something else. But a little string theory is just like this.
But I was thinking maybe something simpler, something like, but it's hard to make, I guess only theory we know is linear Dilator, so we can just make something. But I was thinking maybe some corrections to linear Dilator in some way that would remove.
Yeah, so, and also this is the first of all, it's possible, but again, there's no real reason to remove it. I mean, once we understand where it comes from, then it's just. And if we want to compute the correlation function of the origins, then we can just identify exactly which part of this weird thing and subtract it out.
And actually, this pole, I think, I will not see in a holographic computation, right? So it's just in a gravity. So
oh, it's gravity.
This is really.
No, I think you won't see it because this pole really doesn't just come from the gravity function, basically. I mean, this integral is just sort of the integral space over the these modes. And I think you won't see this also just in the gravity computation.
But they need to set some massive states, right? I guess.
The massive states, I mean, the graviton in this, with momentum in this direction, is just a massive mode. So I think you would see this fall also in gravity in the first week. I phrased this in the language of the world sheet, but doing this interval of the zero mode of pi on the world sheet, but I think you would see exactly the same thing also in space time. At least I don't see why not. I mean, there's nothing especially stringy about this fall, really. It's stringy in the sense of how it's at all, but otherwise it's
I guess it looks like a little bit of fine tuning, so that you really need.
Yeah, it's a fine tuning, maybe kind of the momentum zero. That's why the problem is the special supersymmetric background, that's why it's 400 to zero. Generally, it won't be zero.
That's why I'm thinking that maybe there is some way to deform it, and then this way maybe we can still have some nice decoupling, at least.
Yeah.
That's why gravity may be more useful.
Okay.
Will you still break to check your conjecture with the three-point function?
So that's the next thing. Spacious.
just very technical thing. So are you sure that can you compute the residue also?
The residue, you mean?
Well, sometimes it
happens. The residue you have to put as S matrix and you can compute it, of course.
Yeah, sometimes it happens that you have a zero.
For instance, in a super function, you really have it's really B squared over P squared times P squared, and you really have a zero.
Yeah.
All these things seem to work. In this case, we don't have a zero because we compute it and we find that it really does like one over P squared. So
it's really
possible. Yeah. Originally, when people computed this, they didn't realize that it comes with this. They just computed it by brute force in this SL2 CFT. They found that there is really a fault. So that fault really is there. Any other questions? Okay, so now, as I said, we're going to be brave and try to compute power correlation functions to see if this really makes sense or not. So let me just try how to do that. So again, now we think we understand the lower energy behavior, so we can try to compute arbitrary correlation functions and compare them to what we expect at lower energies and see if we find a improvement or not. So let's take some specific class of correlation functions. So suppose that we look at correlation functions of operators that still have these powers of B in them. So say take a product of traces of B to various powers, after some trace to B and L to the momentum of PL, and then say trace of B star to the power N1 plus H2. And L in order to cancel the charges, for example, this is B star to the N of momentum P, where in order for this to be non zero, it has to be the case that X is the sum over the NIs and P is minus the sum over the PIs, because there's just the null function constraint from the symmetry arguments. And this follows from the case of the free list reserve, and this just follows from momentum conservation. So we're going to try to now compute this in the string theory compared to what we expect in the lower energy field theory. So first, what do we expect in the lower energy field theory? So as I mentioned, the linear perturbation comes from contracting most of these V's to the rev, and just taking one of them and contracting the other. This one has to contract to the V star, so of course it has one of the connected correlation functions, so we have to at least one of those that does contract this smaller field. And the B has to contract to the B star, so the linear perturbation comes from taking one V out of each of these operators and contracting it to the B star, and then all the others we just replace by those devs. So that gives us some contribution, and we expect that contribution to have a pole as a function of each of these momentum, P1 squared after PL squared, coming from the propagator of this mass-less field that's exchanged. And there should be some specific residue of this pole, which you can compute by all of this is free field computations. So that's, and this is not really that, this is not an S matrix computation. To do the S matrix here, I would take the as a function of all L plus one fields. This is not, and that would really, you know, interactions of the theory and so on. This is just a correlation function that's not an S matrix. The matrix it only has L poles, and that just comes from these three field interactions. And we should see that we have the same behavior also in the string theory. So suppose that we now compute the same correlation function now in the string theory, which is V hat and one to V hat and L to the PL. So as I said, we should see the same fault, and we should also be able to compute the residue and compare it to the residue that we find in the field theory and so on. So this correlation function, of course, we do expect it to have a fold function of all of these p's from the arguments before. So the question is just what's the residue of this fold? So this does have some fold. And so the question is, what is this residue? So we computed these correlation functions, and we found that actually they're all zero for every L that's greater than two. So for all these operators, we found exactly zero, which of course does not agree with the numbers that we find here. So it looks like things still don't work the way that we expect them to work, and that we still have some problem with our identifications. And it took us a while to figure out what the problem was. Does anyone want to guess how to fix this? So this is probably the answer. Okay. So the resolution of this problem is that one of the things that I told you was not precisely true. I told you that you can identify each of these beta n operators with Dr. Grace beta n in the Lorentz field theory. But the snatching that we did was just based on the quantum numbers of these operators. Both of them sit in short complex of supersymmetry with the same quantum numbers, so we identified them. But in fact, there are also other operators that have the same quantum numbers under supersymmetry. And there are multiphase operators of the type trace beta n 1 trace beta n minus n 1, and you can also take triple traces and so on. And all of these multiphase operators also have the same quantum numbers, and they're also in short multiples of supersymmetry. So really, all that we know from this operator identifications is that these beta n's should be some linear combination of all of these single trace and multiphase operators. But we don't know exactly which linear combination it is. Usually, we don't worry about these multi-trace operators in ABS-CFT dualities, because usually we work in the limit of large n, where the rank of the gauge group is large, and the proof that these multi-trace operators are negligible. But here, we're not doing that. I mean, here, we really are working with a sort of with a UK theory with finite k, so there's no reason to neglect all these mixins with the multi-trace operators. And so, in principle, So in principle, each of these we had in some linear combination of all of these operators, and so what we have, so and we don't really know the coefficients. So each of these we had is some number that trace beta to n plus some coefficients depending on n one of these trace beta to n one, trace beta to n minus n one, and so on. So what we did next is, so if we assume that there is some generic linear combination here, then we can just plug that into this correlation function and solve for these coefficients, and see if we have a solution or not. So there are lots of different correlation functions here, so this gives us lots of constraints on these coefficients, and it's not so obvious that all these constraints have a solution and so on. But we managed to find a solution for these coefficients, such that indeed, once you plug in that particular linear combination, then all these correlation functions indeed vanish also in the Lorentz field theory. And the answer turns out to take the following form. So the form of this linear combination is not too complicated, and as a matter of fact, of course, there's a huge number of operators that can appear. So we can write it as a sum of our operators with L traces, and then there's a one of L factorial. Then for each, then we sum over the different operators. So for the term with L traces, looks like some one over the one trace b to the n one product up to one over an L trace b to the n L. So this is sort of so far it's the most generic thing that one can write with the delta function that the sum of n one up to n L is equal to n. So this is sort of the most naive thing that one would write down. And then there's the question of what's the coefficient of this. So this is the most general operator that can appear in the extension. And the question is, what is its coefficient? And the coefficient actually turns out to be very simple. It came out to be precisely 1 minus n over k to the power of L minus 1. And in particular, it doesn't depend on all these n's separately. It only depends on this n. So when you normalize the operators in this specific way, then the coefficient terminology have the simple form, which doesn't depend on alpha and I separately, but it only depends on N, L, and K, where again, L is the number of faces, N is the parameter of this operator, and K is the rank of the gauge group. And so this is what we got by solving, directly just by solving these Rossi correlation functions, well, by matching these Rossi correlation functions to the Lorentz field theory. But we can also test this expression and see that it behaves like we expected in various limits. So first of all, one thing we can do is, of course, we can do what we did usually, the CFT gate, and we can try to take K to be very large and see how this behaves there. And when we take K large, then the term here with L equals 1 remain constant. That's the single phrase term, but all the higher phrase terms are down by powers of 1 over K to the number of faces. So this feels like 1 over K to the power L minus 1, which is exactly what you expect from the dual field analysis, that multi-phrase instance will be down by powers of K in the large K limit. So that's one test that this expression makes sense. Another test is to look at what happens when we take, so we want to take large k, but we also want to take n, which is an order of k. Now this parameter n, I remind you, what it's called. So this is basically a u1, but a number, which is where the u1 is part of this SO4 gauge group. So this is a limit of, so this is really some angular momentum quantum number for these NS finites. So this is a limit of large SO4 angular momentum. And it's known for a few years now that if you look at operators, so say in ADS-CFT, when you look at operators with large angular momentum, then you have this phenomenon of giant gravitons, or gravitons with very large momentum, become, in that case, deep derivatives that are on the S3, and which are stabilized by the flux and so on. And the same thing one would expect to happen here. So we'd expect that these operators should also correspond to giant gravitons. In this case, the giant gravitons are not vibrant, but you can show that when you have large momentum on this S3, then the gravitons become elemental strings wrapped on an S1 inside the S3. But basically, exactly the same mechanism that gives the giant gravitons in the ADS-CFT case also gives them here. So we expect that these states should behave like giant gravitons. And then the giant gravitons were identified in the field theory with some determinant operators. So this is the work of both Silvermani and Foucault, Mackey, and Strasser. They show that the mapping of the giant gravitons to the field theory should result in some determinant operators. In particular, for k equals n, it should be precisely the determinant operator. Of course, when we're in these large values of n, then even in the usual ADCP, we do expect to have mixings between different multi-phase operators. And both Silvermani and al. Show that the specific mixing that arises in these giant gravitons states is the one that corresponds to self-determinant operators. And if you look at this formula, then it happens to be the case that if instead of 1 minus n over k to the L minus 1, we would have had minus 1 to the L minus 1, then that's exactly the formula that gives you the self-determinant operators. And actually, we sort of discovered this formula and then verified that it really does give us the self-determinant operators. I haven't seen it anywhere in the literature. And of course, when n is larger than order k, then this is approximately minus 1 to the L minus 1. So we see that also in this very different limit, we see that these operator mixings reproduce exactly what we expect based on the different arguments of the graviton and matching to determinants and so on. So that's another nice consistency check on this formalism. Of course, again, usually in ADS-CFT, we don't have any way to determine whether the string theory vertex operators is a single phrase or if we also include multi-phrases and so on. Well, in the VMN, maybe something can be done about that, but not in the general case. And here, because we really have here an exact conformal field theory with number one or one fields, then that's very powerful. And our computations are really strong enough to tell us precisely what's the mapping between the string theory operators and the field theory operators, including all the operator mixes.
So those constraints that you're solving, are they all with determinant? I guess my question is this solution unique or you believe it is?
So if you look at these specific correlation functions, so this formula have exactly the same number of equations as variables, so that unique determinant is this part. And then you can test that with other correlation functions that involve also other operators, and we saw that it gives consistent results. So if you consider generic correlation functions, then it's only very over determinant. And the solution is
but just with these. Only with these.
Only with these, then it's unique, but you don't have any consistency checks.
Okay.
Any other questions? Yes.
Yeah,
Yeah, so one could imagine that there is a basis of marketplace operators in the field side with semi-grid, other trace, et cetera, et cetera. So there is one particular linear combination which is being used here.
Right.
And that's sort of found to be mapped to one operator here. But one could imagine taking other linear combinations at one.
Well, so again, right. So from the field theory point of view, this really has